Hey, everybody, I'm Ben Swan, in for Rick Sanchez, and this is what we're talking about today.
We are a fighting people, and we will not allow any coup, especially against the constitutionally elected president.
Chaos erupts in Bolivia as an attempted takeover spirals out of control. Armed men storm the grounds of the government palace in a bold move to seize power from President Luis Arce. We've got the wild images, and we'll dig into what this could mean for the future of that South American country. This is Direct Impact. So let's get right to what's happening in Bolivia and the apparent failed coup attempt. On Wednesday morning, armored vehicles rammed into the doors of the government palace, leading to a standoff with President Luis Arce. Bolivian television captured that scene with two tanks and several men in military uniforms outside the building. The soldiers were led by General Juan José Zuniga, known for his anti-government views. Well, in response, President Arce called on his supporters to stand against the perpetrators, sparking a series of clashes. Take a look at some of the footage we collected. Dramatic images there, but what's really going on? Because after only about an hour, the armed troops eventually stood down. Here's where it gets interesting. Juan José Zuniga, who is now under arrest, claims that President Arce instructed him to prepare that show of force to boost his popularity. So now let's go to international correspondent Manila Chan. So Manila, what's your take on this? The defense claims coming in from Zuniga that this was not actually a coup, this was a false flag.
Well, Ben, there were memes circulating on Twitter yesterday about this very short-lived coup. I mean, some calling it the pizza coup online because, you know, the coup began and ended faster than some people could order a pizza and have it delivered. But it is an interesting allegation by General Zuniga. Right now, there is no evidence to support such a claim, you know, that he was ordered to do this fake coup in order to help bolster Luis Arce's sagging support. But behind Zuniga's defense claim upon his arrest, that is, that there is a growing rift among the MAS party and its direction and its leadership, by whom, with the return from exile of Evo Morales in late 2020, and now he's announcing that he wants to run for yet another term in 2025. This adds another layer to the political mess that is Bolivia. Now, if you recall, back in 2019, when Morales first fled after that military coup at that time, opposition senator Jeanine Añez declared herself interim president, much in the way that Juan Guaido did in Venezuela, with foreign support from the American government and groups like OAS. Now, she gave the green light to the military at that time to quash dissent by pro-Morales protesters, allowing the military to shoot and kill 33 demonstrators. So it was a very tumultuous time, coupled with the COVID pandemic that hit during the political strife. The elections got rescheduled, and ultimately, the MAS party still prevailed, which put Luis Arce in office in 2020. So Zuniga's claims against Arce really don't make any sense in the broader picture. If recent history tells us anything, it would say that there's outside influence at play here once again, Ben.
Well, if there is outside play, I'm not saying there isn't, but it's so pathetic. The whole thing was so, as you said, it was short-lived. It was so weak. What a weak attempt at a coup. It's hard to believe that anyone could have organized this, but maybe more on that in a bit. Let's move to this other story. So Brussels is set to sign a defense pact with Ukraine on Thursday. The agreement, it aims to bolster Ukraine's security and defense in 9 key areas, including weapons deliveries, of course, military training, of course, building up the defense industry cooperation. It's not a mutual defense treaty, though. I'm sure you can imagine why. The pact promises swift EU consultation and action in case of future aggression. Manila, this is a pretty significant move by the EU, but it's yet another example of their commitment to defending Ukraine, keeping the U.S. satisfied, it seems like. But at the same time, again, this is not a mutual defense agreement. What does that mean? It means so if the EU is attacked, we're not going to call on Ukraine, maybe because they have no military left and they're drafting 15 to 60-year-olds into the army.
Yeah, I mean, so Ben, we can characterize it that way, you know, but we can also view it through the lens of, say, celebrity marriage. And here's what I mean by that. First, who is this guy that signed the pact for the Ukraine side? I mean, Zelensky's term as president ended in May. Based on Ukrainian law, in lieu of inaugurating a new president, the interim role should be passed to their version of Speaker of the House. So Zelensky's signature on this whole thing is dubious. Now, the pact itself is only 12 pages long, and it only outlines funding through the end of 2024, which is coincidentally when the world will learn who becomes the new American president. Mm-hmm. But it does talk about wider security measures, as you mentioned, which includes cooperation in the way of military training and aid to Ukraine, specifically only to Ukraine. But what I found most interesting was that it specifically talks about countering cyber threats, as well as, and this is a quote, foreign information manipulation and interference. Translation, the continued censorship of any Russian-related media, content, or even dissent against the EU or U.S. role in making this a protracted war.
Yeah, well, and that's absolutely true. Look, the persecution of journalists of online media in Ukraine is pretty astounding. But when you look at, like, American companies like YouTube and Facebook and the work that they have done to squash any kind of dissent, not only at the behest of the FBI, but at the behest of Ukraine's SBU, it is remarkable to think the kind of influence that it's having worldwide. But let's move on to this other story, too. We've talked about this earlier this week. Julian Assange, finally back home in Australia, the WikiLeaks founder, reunited with his family after finalizing a deal, pleading guilty to a single charge of conspiracy. In return, he'll receive credit for time served, avoiding any further jail time. Take a look at the moments that he returned home here.
He's hugging Stella.
Oh, Stella there?
Yeah, he's hugging her now.
Oh.
He picked her up in the air. Dad. Dad.
It was us meeting on the tarmac, but it was the entire world who was celebrating. Julian plans to swim in the ocean every day. He plans to sleep in a real bed. He plans to taste real food, and he plans to enjoy his freedom.
Well, pretty incredible stuff. Now, while the celebration is taking place in Australia, the mood in Washington, as you might imagine, is more subdued. Despite Assange pleading guilty to that single charge of conspiracy to commit crime, espionage, a court ruled that his actions did not endanger anyone. Here's the thing, though. A State Department spokesperson, Matthew Miller, seemed to have missed that memo, insisting to reporters that Assange, yes, he did do wrong, without really explaining what that was. Listen to this.
But are you satisfied that the case is over?
So look, the Justice Department has spoken to that, and I don't have anything to add. The ambassador put out a statement that said we were happy to work with our Australian colleagues on it, and that remains the case. I do think it is important when we talk about Julian Assange to remind the world that the actions for which he was indicted and for which he has now pled guilty are actions that put the lives of our partners, our allies, and our diplomats at risk, especially those who work in dangerous places like Afghanistan and Iraq.
Sorry, man. So I actually did cover the State Department back then, and I don't remember there being any public, there was a public concern that was raised about the potential security risk posed to sources who might have been quoted. Was there actually any, did you ever discover anyone who was injured, killed, had to go into hiding because of them?
So a few things about that. One, I can't give you a definitive answer only because I wasn't here at the time. You know, if you drive drunk down the street and get pulled over for drunk driving, the fact that you didn't crash into another car and kill someone doesn't get you out of the reckless actions and the endangerment that you put your fellow citizens in. And it's the same thing, the same principle applies here.
Right. Well, I don't think that it does. But the fact of the matter is that the State Department has been, at least as far as I know, and maybe I'm wrong, but has never been able to point to anyone who was compromised or killed or.
All right. Manila, this is an insane, insane press conference. So Matthew Miller is standing there saying, Julian Assange put our partners at risk. He endangered the lives of Americans and our diplomats and spies. He endangered so many people. And then the reporter says, who? And he says, I don't know. I wasn't here. I mean, what kind of a response is this?
Ben, I mean, I have no words to describe Matt Miller. Actually, I do have some words, but the FCC won't allow me to say them.
Yeah.
That was such a laughable answer that he gave. You know, that was before my time here. What a lame response. I mean, I wasn't alive during the JFK era, but I know what happened during his administration because guess what, Ben? I can read and seek answers to the questions that I might have. What kind of weak answer was this from a guy who's supposed to be, you know, a government official? He's actually hired to speak for a living. It was a weaselly way out of having to be further pressed on a topic that, you know, being harmed by WikiLeaks or the Assange releases.
But Manila, it's not just that nobody was harmed. You can argue that people's lives were saved because of Julian Assange. The fact that you had people, large numbers of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan dying as a result of what was taking place there. And then you have Julian Assange and WikiLeaks revealing it. And I would say turning the course of the Iraq war, turning the course of the Afghanistan war, and bringing an end to the massacre of civilians. It wasn't that he was endangering people, he's saving people, and this clown is standing there saying, no, I think it's really bad. It's bad. It's so bad. Tell me what's bad about it. I don't know. Not really sure.
Somebody told me. I wasn't here.
Terrible.
I wasn't here.
Awful.
Ben.
Yeah. Real quick, we're on time.
We use the term harm very loosely these days. I mean, I can't speak to anyone's feelings or reputations of being hurt or harmed. But to date, there is no evidence that any person whose name was even mentioned in those docs had a hair on their heads harmed. So, all of this is just a weak response because they have no answer.
We got to go. But look, Julian Assange, the thing he harmed was the reputation of the U.S. military and organizations like the CIA that were committing crimes against people, and he embarrassed permanent Washington. He embarrassed the Bush administration, the Obama administration.
Absolutely.
And that's why he was in prison. Manila, we get fired up on this, but thanks for doing that. All right, still ahead. We circle back to our top story of the day, that dramatic failed coup attempt, if it really was one, in Bolivia. Find out why some are pointing fingers at the U.S. for allegedly being involved. We'll break it all down right after the break. Stay tuned.
In Russia's southern region of Astrakhan, where the mighty Volga flows into the Caspian Sea, forming the largest estuary in continental Europe, which means it's a great place to learn about fish.
Welcome back to our show and the top story of the day, the failed coup attempt in Bolivia. theories are swirling on X, formerly Twitter, speculating that the coup attempt was covertly backed by the CIA, which they do all the time in Latin America, so why not this one, right? Some are pointing to Bolivia's extensive lithium reserves. So let's break it down. Despite holding the world's largest lithium reserves, Bolivia has struggled to industrialize the resource. However, recent agreements with the Chinese and Russian companies in 2023, it could transform Bolivia's economy. And this development is not sitting well with officials in Washington. Big surprise there. So joining us now to discuss, we have Camila Escalante. She is a journalist based in Latin America. Camila, thanks for being here. First of all, kind of take us through this recent coup attempt. Videos burst onto social media, but an interesting meme on X pointed out that the time from the beginning of this so-called coup attempt to its end took less time than ordering and having a pizza delivered. Was this a serious threat, do you think, to the establishment? Was this a real coup? I know that there is a claim by Zuniga, General Zuniga, that he was put up to this. Do you believe that, or do you believe this was a failed coup attempt by an outside power?
These are the same questions that everyone inside of Bolivia is asking right now. Everyone from the left, represented by the Movement Towards Socialism, the party led by Evo Morales, and the right wing, the far right, who led the coup in 2019. They're asking the same questions. And I think just normal everyday supporters of the government want to know as well. What exactly transpired? What were the conversations that were had during what looked like a confrontation or a discussion between Zuniga and President Luis Arce and his ministers there in the government palace for a number of minutes? They stood face to face. You saw people pointing, putting their hands up. And what we do know is that reportedly the Minister of Government or Interior Minister, perhaps in English, would told the this commander that he needed to stand down and tell his officers to withdraw from Plaza Murillo. The government also said that they would not be adhering to the demands to resign and move over so that the military or this faction of the military could install their own leadership in the country. And just like that, it seemed that they withdrew. And of course, in a matter of minutes, Luis Arce and his vice president headed inside and they named a whole new high command of the military, which is really interesting. It means that Luis Arce survived what took place, although he is probably in a very weak position because since 2019, we've seen a number of changes to the high command of both the military and the police. So now there are also questions about whether something like this could happen again, whatever it is that is investigated or what they decide that this actually was. Could it happen again? They have elections in Bolivia in 2025. And right now there is a concerted effort by the right wing and by those who carried out the coup in 2019, as well as their allies in the exterior, that would be the US and its allies, to try to sow division in the country and destabilize the country and split up the left so that the right has some fighting chance at actually winning an election.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how much attention is on Bolivia right now. And I guess the elephant in the room when it comes to Bolivia, certainly those lithium reserves we mentioned, Bolivia has more than enough lithium to make the country awfully prosperous and wealthy. And it looks like the country's leadership wants to head in that direction with investment, again, as we mentioned, from China. Bolivia's president meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum earlier this month. None of that is a good sign, we would take it, for Washington. Take us through just how much lithium Bolivia has and where the country's current kind of lithium extraction and production industry stands right now. There's been talk over recent years about nationalizing lithium reserves in order for the whole country to prosper. But as you mentioned, the right wing isn't a fan of that, and certainly outside powers like the U.S., they hate that idea.
Yeah, Bolivia has nationalized its lithium reserves. And as Southcom in the United States always speaks about, this area of Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia has the most lithium in all of the world. And it's been a process, a very interesting process over the last few years since Luis Arce came to power in Bolivia following the triumph of the Bolivian people over the coup, that they have been needing to look for these partners to try to develop that lithium. And of course, this has been a little bit of a political thing as well, because there are bidders, potential partners from the United States, from China, Russia, and many other countries of the world who want to develop with Bolivia. So this is something that's always a factor. And this is directly linked to what, you know, any destabilization or anything that we see in the country. We can't say right now, we can only speculate what sort of outside powers, to return to your first question, mm-hmm. might have been involved in what took place in the planning. We know that something was planned. The commander himself said that he met with the different commanders of the armed forces. He was the head of the military. He said that he had the support of certain actors of the Air Force and the Navy as well. He actually said that the reason he was unsuccessful in reaching his aims of overthrowing the government, or according to him, restoring democracy yesterday, was because the armed forces, or sorry, the Navy and the Air Force didn't actually show up at Plaza Murillo as they were supposed to. But if it is the case that a lot of planning and plotting went into what happened, what transpired yesterday over the course of the past weeks, we do have to ask what sort of discussions were held between the armed forces and members of the right-wing opposition and any sort of allies they have in the exterior, whether it be the U.S. Embassy in La Paz or any other countries that participated in organizing or supporting and legitimizing the coup in 2019. Was it that sort of a thing? These are the questions that are being asked.
Yeah, and they're big questions. Look, you go to Latin America and South America and you see Chinese influence everywhere right now. Obviously, the Belt and Road Initiative has been pretty powerful in terms of the changes that are being made in Latin and South America. You also see that the model of coup that the United States has run now for, you know, many, many decades, where they go into a country and they decide, well, we want to control this either economically, we want to bring multinational corporations in here and give them control, and so they engineer these coups. And it's become such a playbook. We watch it play out over and over and over. We saw it playing out in Venezuela with Juan Guaido and the attempt that the U.S. had there to install him as the leader of the country. And so we see this taking place all the time. I'm just curious as to what is happening in Latin America and South America in terms of the shift by people in those countries who say, look, the Chinese and the Russians treat us differently. I feel like the U.S. uses this hammer-first approach where they want to go in, smash everything, and then say, don't worry, we'll put it back together the right way using your own people, which it never is, really. And the Chinese have a very different model. In the long run, how do you see this playing out, especially when you have a country that is so rich in lithium? It seems like the Chinese-Russian model of saying, let's work with you, rather than trying to overthrow and basically take it all from you, seems to work better.
It does work better. You asked a number of questions there. I think it's going to be very tricky for Luis Arce, who is vying for re-election 2025, to get re-elected without the support of the broader left and the movement towards socialism led by Evo Morales. That is what the United States and its allies is focusing on. They're focusing on sowing division within the country, within the revolutionary sectors, within, that is the people who supported the radical change under Evo Morales, and the campesinos, the rural people, and the unions, of course, and the indigenous sectors. Those people are going to need to support Luis Arce or Evo Morales or whoever it is for this project to remain in power. And these are people who largely support the project of developing jointly with countries like China and Russia. Luis Arce has been very savvy on the foreign policy front, just like Evo Morales. Even though there has been a crisis internally and there has been some economic problems, particularly in the last couple of years, he has had very solid foreign policy when it comes to Palestine, when it comes to Iran, and obviously Russia. So that's very key. That means that he has a lot of support and legitimacy internationally. And he's seen as having some sort of a strong voice on particular issues. I think that it's going to be more of an internal struggle within the country to see if he can garner that support and remain in power. This, of course, was the fifth consecutive government elected by the Bolivian people. Only four of them have been carried out. The fourth of the five was when Evo Morales was reelected in 2019. But of course, he was not able to serve his fourth term because of the coup. So this is what they're trying to avoid right now. Another destabilization attempt, another entry of these NGOs and so-called human rights organizations, funded, of course, mm-hmm. by the NED, by USAID, et cetera, that will disrupt the process.
Yeah, and whenever the NGOs come in, you know you're going in the wrong direction. Last question for you. We have about a minute left. If this coup was, in fact, engineered by Western partners, by the United States and others, how embarrassing is it? We talk about the model of the coup has been run for a long time. It seems to get progressively worse. It seems to become progressively incompetent. If this one does turn out to be U.S.-led, is it just an embarrassment at this point to have put together something so shoddy, so inept, and to now have Washington's stamp on this? Does it just further destroy credibility there?
Well, it shows that the, you know, Washington allied sectors are completely inept in the country. It's not the only coup attempt we've seen. We saw so many coup attempts and actually assassination attempts against Evo Morales during his 14 years of presidency. We saw one coup, but we've seen many attempts against Luis Arce's presidency. We've seen destabilization. We've seen violent groups take to the streets and hold roadblocks and all sorts of other things in the Department of Santa Cruz and otherwise. This is the one that took the headlines internationally because we saw so many armored vehicles and hundreds of military literally ram down the front doors of the government palace. But it's not the first time, and it won't be the last time. They have all been failed attempts, and it just means that the right wing in the country, the opposition, has no strength, it has no people, it has no project, and no one is supporting it except these exterior powers and their vast amount of money and influence.
Camila Escalante, thank you so much for your time, your insight. We've learned a lot today. Thank you.
Thanks.
That is our show for you today. I'm Ben Swan. We'll see you next time covering stories that have a direct impact.